Today, the Bitcoin conundrum. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Stephen, the very famous podcaster who spends all his time talking about Bitcoin. Hi there.
Hi, Martin. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you with me. And I think it would be good just to give the audience a bit of background. As I said, you do a lot of podcasting on this subject, so very much in your home territory. But just give people a bit of an introduction.
Of course, yeah. So I am mostly known as a Bitcoin podcast host. So my show is called the Stefan Levera Podcast, right? Just self-titled show. And basically, it's known as a Bitcoin and Austrian economics show. So I interview many of the leading names within the Bitcoin space and also a lot of economists as well to sort of offer a bit of a macroeconomic perspective on that. And so that's essentially what I'm most known for. And then I also have another business, which is Ministry of Nodes, which is basically teaching people how to use Bitcoin if they would like to. So that's kind of that's what I'm mostly known for in this space.
Excellent. And I obviously haven't got your name quite right. I apologize for that. I should have asked you.
That's fine.
I should have asked the obvious question, but I didn't. So that. Now, look, before we get into Bitcoin specifically, let's just talk about macro, right? Because I think macro is really interesting at the moment insofar that we've had a very significant run-up in some asset prices. And you can say that, in the crypto area, as well as gold, as well as stocks. And of course, a lot of that is directly connected to the fact that central banks around the world have been printing like billio and probably will do a lot more. What's your perspective on all of this? Do you think there is real value, or do you think this is a bubble, or in how are you reading it?
Of course. I mean, I'm more in the line of thinking it's a bubble, right? So I think, I'm coming from a more free market libertarian perspective. And so for me, I'm skeptical of the existence of central banking and of fiat money. And obviously that's part of the Bitcoin angle, right?
Yeah.
Now, in terms of where we are right now, I think it's quite clear that it's sort of like there's this house of cards, and essentially the governments and the central banks of the world, they're sort of trying to do what they can to kind of kick the can as much as they can. And so my view of the world is more like, if the government were not to try and keep kind of injecting liquidity, we would see the prices sort of come back to the ground. And essentially that, I think probably the best example of that is, I mean, if you look at how high the unemployment rates are around the world, and yet we're seeing like stock markets are like still pumping like crazy. And it's just sort of like, if you're coming from any sort of traditional investor mindset, you're typically thinking, okay, what's the discount capital, what's the discount cash flows of this stock, and what kind of future returns can I anticipate? And then obviously in this environment, who can predict anything, right? I mean, people have just had their businesses shut down, they're locked inside their own homes in Melbourne or around the world. It's absolutely insane. So to see the prices rising at a time like this, to me, I'm quite skeptical of that.
Now, you mentioned Austrian, and I guess a lot of people will have heard the phrase but probably don't really understand what this particular doctrinal position, if I can put it like that, is. So let's unpack that a bit, because I think this will be really important. Many people actually are closet Austrians, I would suggest, but let's just go through it. So what are the critical dimensions of this particular position with regard to the economy?
Sure. So Austrian economics, essentially, it was named that because some of the early practitioners came from Austria. Nowadays, most of the actual practitioners of the Austrian school of thought, if you will, are in America. And now the Austrian school is known for its particular method of economics. It's known as praxeology. So it's sort of trying to understand what are the underlying, what's like the fundamental assumption, and then deducing from that. Now, in practice, what does that really mean? It means a focus on the choices that an individual makes, and then what do those choices make when you ripple those out to the rest of the economy? And so typically, I guess just shortcutting it for the listener as well, typically Austrian economists tend to be very free market in their policy prescriptions. And it's not because they kind of just kind of wanted things to come out and say, yeah, that was the best outcome. It's more like once you reason it out and understand having an appreciation for these different concepts that come up in Austrian economics, that's essentially why Austrians are skeptical of kind of the interventions into the economy. And so probably the biggest kind of quintessentially Austrian piece is what's known as Austrian business cycle theory. And so I'm sure you would have heard of this. And essentially the idea is that as the government influences the market for money and interest rates, entrepreneurs get sent the wrong signal. That causes what we call malinvestment. Now, colloquially, we might just think of that like it's bubbles, right? The housing bubble, the dot-com bubble, and so on. And the Austrians have a theory, and that theory helps explain why you see a cluster of errors. It's not because normally in normal capitalism, you see businesses fail, and that's standard, right? Some fail, some win, etc. But why is it that we see this cluster of errors into a certain industry? Why is that? And that's the Austrian insight and way of thinking about the way the economy is structured is what Austrian economists will explain. And so that is one of the quintessential things that I think an Austrian understanding can help us see. And it is important because it means, well, if you're going through something, it's best to understand correctly what is the actual problem before you start thinking, okay, what's the solution? Oh, we need more liquidity. And that's sort of, or we need more stimulus. And that's, it's important to understand conceptually what's going on there.
Yeah, and I think the cornerstone, as you say, is a free market view, which essentially says a couple of things. One is that capital will generally flow to those areas that can create more value over time. But you also recognize that some of those will fail. And in fact, failure is part of the mechanism, isn't it?
That's right. And so the Austrians look at, you know, the crash, if you will, as a bit of a corrective. And that's not because we like people to go out of business and so on. It's because we're appreciating that actually the resources got sent into the wrong, quote unquote, wrong pathway, if you will. And so this is actually part of the corrective. And so it's like, to an Austrian, this idea of, oh, just more liquidity, pump it in, is kind of like saying, just give me more drugs. I don't want to go to rehab, right? That's the analogy. Yeah. And so I guess one other point I would add there is just that it relates to how entrepreneurs get sent the wrong signal. And in so doing, they have access to artificially cheap credit, like cheaper than it would have otherwise been if you think about the counterfactual. And so then that entrepreneur is able to bid away the resources from other entrepreneurs, as in those ones. And so that changes the structure of the economy. And that is why we end up with these kind of dot-com bubble, housing bubble, etc. We end up with these bubbles in certain areas.
And that's the really important point. It's the misallocation of capital. And, you know, if you think that capital is not necessarily an infinite resource, although some these days would suggest it probably is. But the fact is that if you've got a choice of one, two or three places where you might actually put that capital in a free market, it should naturally flow to those which can create superior value over time. Whereas if in fact you're manipulating the market and putting liquidity in and those sorts of things, then you start propping up, for example, zombie companies like in the US, where many, many companies basically have been propped up simply because the money is very cheap. They've been able to issue bonds. They've used the funds from those bonds to buy back shares. And therefore, they've created this artificial view of the value of their company, despite the fact that actually, in real terms, they might not even be covering the costs of running the company in their core business. That's, you know, a classic example of capital misallocation. And again, if you are actually spending a lot of money propping up the housing sector, which we do in Australia, right? And even the government now has said, well, we're going to throw massive stimulus in to help the construction sector. What are we not investing then in? And maybe should be investing elsewhere, perhaps for the future, you know, whatever it is. And so again, it's an example of misallocation. And it's a fundamental issue specifically when you have manipulation, and often from politicians as well as central banks and all those things, because they think that they somehow know best, right? And so they can't let the market be the market. What they're doing is effectively trying to impose their own will over the top. And I guess you'd argue, and I think I probably agree, that the central banks like Fed, for example, in the global financial crisis, made a tactical error and probably more significant a strategic error by trying to prop everything up a decade plus ago. And in fact, what we're seeing playing out now is really errors that were made then.
100%. And I think it doesn't just start there. I mean, it even goes further back, right? I think it's essentially that they just keep papering it over, right? So every time they just kind of they just try to reflate the bubble, right? They just say, yep, let's just keep putting more and more in. But I guess it's complicated, right? Because you've got the central bank, you've got, and then you've got the money that's created out there in the private sector, right? But we have to understand that that private sector is backstopped by the central bank, right? There are implicit or sometimes explicit bailout guarantees. There's deposit guarantees. The central bank is acting as a lender of last resort. There's legal tender laws that force you to use a certain, you know, Australian dollar, US dollar, et cetera. And so these factors push us into this system. And so there are different ways in which money gets created and multiplied up, if you will. And so there's a few different, like there's all these different components to it. And arguably, central banks don't necessarily even understand the full picture. There are very few people who even do. I wouldn't say I do, but I think it's really starting to, you know, become more and more clear to me over the years that everyone's kind of flying in the dark a little bit here, because there's this whole sort of creation of money outside of the central banks that the central banks don't necessarily have good visibility into. And so I think, to me, it all drives back to, like, we have to understand what was the root cause of this problem, right? The root cause is that we have unsound money. We have money that's very easy for people to start fractional reserving up on top of that, as opposed to having a certain money that we know this is the limit. You know, in Bitcoin, it's 21 million and no more. That's how many Bitcoins that will exist, right? And so that, in our view, the Bitcoin of you is more like, we can more appropriately plan out into the future, because I know however many Bitcoins I have, that fraction of 21 million, that's how much I know I have. These are the rules of the game. I opt into those. There's no additional kind of money creation happening off elsewhere, because it's, in that sense, it obsolates fractional reserve banking, because people will just kind of tend back towards a full reserve system. So the way I view it playing out over time is that we will move towards a more equity-based society as opposed to a debt-based society. So right now there's a lot of debt, and it's very cheap debt. And that's to the advantage of governments. That's to their advantage, because they want to borrow, because they want to have government bonds. They benefit from having this market for cheap liquidity for them. And so if they had to explicitly tax us up front, that would change that game. And so I think I view Bitcoin as like this hard money that's kind of going to reassert kind of a new type of money onto the rest of the world. And now we're starting to see more and more people come into Bitcoin because they can see, oh, actually, all these things that are going on around me, the government can change the rules of the game underneath me. It can pull the rug out from me underneath me, right? What I thought was my property or my business is now locked down. It's gone. Or it's not gone, but I'm restricted in how I can interact with it. Whereas when you learn how to correctly interact with Bitcoin, when you hold your own, you know, Bitcoin private keys and so on, and you run the software, you can now interact in a way that's more, you have a kind of what's called like a deep safety. You're not reliant so much on other institutions like a bank or whatever to let your transactions go through or whatever. And so in that way, it's sort of like having a special kind of property. It's a special kind of assurance that the fiat banking system cannot provide us.
Yeah, and that is really the point, isn't it? And that's why there are a number of advocates to Bitcoin. And I guess when you're talking Bitcoin, are you really just talking Bitcoin, or are you talking across the pantheon of cryptocurrencies that exist?
Right, and so this is another big point of contention within the community. I personally, I'm Bitcoin only. I don't bother with the others, but I'm happy to explain why, right? I think it's sort of like it's Bitcoin, and then there's all these other quote-unquote cryptocurrencies that are sort of riding the coattails of Bitcoin. And so for me, what matters most is the network effect of Bitcoin, right? And so there's a few things. So network effect, having a credibly limited supply, right? We know that it's basically impossible to raise that 21 million cap. You're just not going to do it. It's decentralized enough that people can interact with it, and you can do so in a way that's very cheap. Right, so you can interact with the network just on a smartphone if you really wish. You can buy a cheap Raspberry Pi and run the Bitcoin software on that. Like a Raspberry Pi is a cheap computer for those of you who aren't familiar. And so then, it's a combination of all these things that give Bitcoin special qualities and characteristics. So in terms of those network effects, it's about how many people are holding. People want to hold and use Bitcoin. Merchants who want to accept it. Exchanges, Bitcoin exchanges who offer it, developers who are developing like up on the code for that software and the wallets to interact with Bitcoin. And so it's all these different network effects that are all reinforcing each other. And so in my view, though there are other cryptocurrencies, none of them really represent a real chance to win in the market for money, right? And I guess this comes back to, again, an Austrian point I would say, which is that we have to think about how money arises on the market. And why is it that we have fiat money now, right? Is fiat money a natural occurrence, or was it a government kind of sponsored innovation, if you will? So our view is more like money arises on the market. And at any given time, there's lots of different assets that might be in some sense competing to become the money of the world. And it only just so happens that we use different fiat currencies because every country and every government, obviously they want to have their own, it gives them more power. And they can impose legal tender laws and all manner of other laws, capital gains tax laws and so on, that try to force people into a certain, into Australian dollar or whatever fiat currency. Where I view Bitcoin is like this kind of neutral international money. It doesn't have any sovereign. There is no CEO. There's no government that controls it. And so in that way, it's sort of like we can transact in a way without having to trust each other. It's like the network gives us assurances that we don't have to trust any specific bank. Right. So one saying, actually, I like this saying, it's Bitcoin is the money of enemies. Right. So if you had to, you know, if people were like warring, you know, tribes or whatever, and they would give each other gold because gold was like the well kind of established money, or people were doing a dowry, or they were doing like inheritance, you know, from one generation to another. It was kind of it was like this neutral money. It wasn't this one coin that one of them had made that the other accepted. Well, they got to use something that neither of them control. And so in some ways, Bitcoin is like a digital version of that. And that's why I'm so bullish on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you can see that the volume of transactions continues to rise as more people get into it. And actually, quite recently, there's been quite a run-up, isn't there, in terms of demand. I guess some of the government checks that people may have received around the world, some of that has gone into the Bitcoin sector as well as to gold and other places. So it's, you know, all part of the momentum. But the point I wanted to make was, you have to take a strategic long-term view about this, right? Because this is still quite early in its evolution, it seems to me. And, you know, there have been some rides up and rides down and rides up and ride down. So the value is quite variable. But I guess as the momentum strengthens and as the network effect gets stronger, and I think the network effect is something people really need to understand. In other words, the more of it that goes on, the more connectivity there is, the more stable it becomes and the more important it becomes, right? Like fax machines, you can have one fax machine that's pretty useless. If you had 20 fax machines, it's slightly useful. If you had a million fax machines, it's quite a lot more useful. That's sort of what a network effect is. But I guess my question is that with the blockchain conversation that we have, there's still a lot of nervousness in mainstream land about cryptocurrencies in particular and blockchain, and it's still seen as a speculation and it's still seen as highly risky. How do you sort of answer some of those, if you like, probably criticisms that may not be well-founded, but nevertheless are criticisms that keep coming back?
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, I get this question all the time. So look, the way I see it is you have to sort of think in terms of the longer term. And so for most of us in Bitcoin, if you've been around for a long enough time, you've basically been, basically people who buy and hold with a long-term focus, those are the ones who have all done well. People who try to sort of short-term trade in and out, those are the ones who necessarily aren't doing that well. And now there's a couple, I guess there's two main ways to think of this. So like, I try to be fair as well, right? Obviously I'm bullish on Bitcoin, right? Yeah. So part one, obviously a big part of it is speculative demand. Right. And I'll be honest, that is that it's people are speculating on this as future further adoption based on certain characteristics. Right. So for us, it comes down to what makes a better money, even in that idealized kind of theoretical sense, like how scarce is it? How fungible is it? Each of the coins are the same kind of thing. How easy is it to transact? How does it fare against its competition? Right. It's cheaper to move Bitcoin around the world than it is to, say, move gold around the world. And so it's this idea of the final settlement. Right. So, yeah. But bringing it back to your point about, you know, the volatility and people being a little bit unsure of it, I think part of that is openness to new technology. Part of that is just time for understanding, because it takes some work to understand it. And I think the way to think of it is the longer it's been around for more people, it's just been, it's part of the furniture. It's been around for your whole life. And over time, you know, I'm sure in the first few days, whenever someone wanted to buy something off the internet, that's like, whoa, what do you mean? Like put my credit card details in online? No, I'm not doing that, right? And obviously over time, more and more people started to see the benefits of that. And so in Bitcoin, the benefits are, like I said, there's one and two. So one is kind of speculation, being fair about it. Now, for some of us who are long-term in Bitcoin, we think of it as long-term savings, right? But for someone who's not in this world, speculation. Part two is permissionlessness, right? So this ability to transact and nobody can stop you, right? So I could be in whatever country around the world, I can set up a Bitcoin wallet and I can just take payment in Bitcoin just like that. You know, if I've been, whether I'm someone in the Western world and I've been canceled by PayPal or Patreon or one of these things, or whether I'm someone in developing countries who would like to start accepting Bitcoin as a new, like I'm a web developer or I'm a whatever, I can start taking payment for that. And I think in a world where you have to look as well at the broader macro picture as well of what's going on. So I think it's fair to say colloquially, there's a war on cash going on. So even here in Australia, right, there were some of the banks, there were some articles talking about how coronavirus, basically because of all this panic, right, people have, they've accelerated the timeline for shutting down ATMs and branches here in Australia by 5 years. So that's arguably also an acceleration of the war on cash. And so now that means it becomes easier and easier for somebody who wants to enforce financial repression onto the population, because they are now paying, in a sense, the inflation tax. Obviously, it's colloquial, right? But it's kind of like the inflation is higher than the amount of interest that you get from your bank. Well, when, once we start going into, and I mean, we arguably already are in a negative real interest rate environment, but it may get even more like closer and closer to zero or even literally negative nominal interest rates, right? Now, that may be some time off, but that is also kind of a broader macro trend that we have to consider. And so for those of us who are thinking about, well, how do I save my value into the longer term? Yes, it's going to be volatile. And yes, Bitcoin moves in these big waves, but I believe it will continue to be volatile. But I guess the other kind of way of thinking about it that I would communicate is, imagine you've got a bucket of water and you drop a, you know, you drop a stone in there. Obviously, it'll cause a big ripple. But if I go to the ocean and I throw a rock in there, well, it's going to be barely nothing, right? So it's the same kind of idea. Bitcoin right now is extremely young. It is kind of off the top of my head, it's like 150 billion or 200 billion in terms of market cap, if you will. Gold, for comparison's sake, is like 7 or 8, maybe 9 trillion, something in that range. So, you know, and global M3 US dollar is probably something like 90 trillion. Right. So we're talking like it is just so small as a fraction of what it could, the markets that it's competing for. Hmm. So that's also part of the reason for many of us speculating into Bitcoin.
Right. And of course, that's the point. The potentiality, right, is the critical thing. And you made the point earlier on, that's just worth reiterating. There is a finite supply. Right. So effectively, if there are more people wanting to use it, by definition, the value goes up. That's yeah, a fundamental. Right. So that's something that people should bear in mind. But I guess the other point people need to understand is that at any point in time, the price of Bitcoin is driven by the transactions which are currently going on the various exchanges. I mean, there's no centralized, you know, mechanism, right? It is all about supply demand on every exchange. And so one, you can get some variations between different exchanges, and two, you can get quite a lot of volatility sometimes depending on supply demand. And that's part of, I guess, designed into the way that Bitcoin works, but it is also something which a lot of people will feel uncomfortable about.
Absolutely. So absolutely, I certainly take your point there. There are many now, there's hundreds of exchanges around the world, and just like on your stock broking platform, you've got an order book, you know, buys and sells, same like that. And they sell Bitcoin there. And you're absolutely right to point out that it is highly volatile. And so there are some traders out there who will try and arbitrage across the exchanges, right, to try and equalize across exchanges. But there still will be a difference. And basically what we've seen, I guess, the way I would suggest to think about Bitcoin is think of it like it's a cycle thing. Right. So it's kind of like 4 year cycles. So in, you know, 2012, we had the price is like $12. Then in like March or April of 2013, it went to like $260. Then it went to like, yeah. So it, but those people who bought and held on for a long period of time have all come out ahead. And so that is kind of the way to, I guess, think about it. But what you'll see is during those crazy kind of frenzies, right? So at least in the time that I've been around in Bitcoin, since around 2013 days, I saw that first, well, those frenzies in 2013 when there was like the Mt. Gox run to 1200, right? And that was like a big deal. And then the more recent one, which I'm sure many of your listeners know about, is obviously 2017. Now, at that time, it was like you looked at, if you people were trying to sign up on an exchange, they couldn't even get signed up, right? Or they were trying to withdraw, they couldn't get the money out. And there was all these kind of factors. And so every time the whole ecosystem of Bitcoin, they sort of tool up and they skill up in terms of ability to handle that new wave of people coming in. But it is fundamentally still very much driven by those kinds of cycles, if you will. And that is something that anyone who's into Bitcoin has to be comfortable with, that level of volatility.
Right. And I guess as well as volatility, there's also the question of transaction throughput and just how many transactions an hour can be done, because relative to some of the other cryptos, it's actually quite limited, isn't it?
That's right. So yeah, that's a great, it's an important point to discuss, right? And so here I would try to help for the listener just to mentally separate in your mind the concept method of payment versus medium of exchange, right? And I think that's probably the important thing to distinguish here. So quick example, I could send you, $10. I could go up to you and hand you that in cash, like just literally physical cash. Or I could use PayPal to transfer you $10 over PayPal, right? It's the same medium of exchange. Mm. It's just that we've used different methods. And so in Bitcoin, the confusing thing is that yes, Bitcoin has it's a network as well, but it is also a token, a monetary token. So I can transfer Bitcoin in multiple ways, right? I can do it on chain, like in terms of a standard Bitcoin transaction, or I could do it through other means. So in Bitcoin, we have a thing called Lightning Network. And so that's like, if I want to do fast, smaller size transactions, I would typically use Lightning for that kind of example. And I think it's also important to sort of understand what Bitcoin is. And I think that's a common confusion for people, right? Because people are sort of thinking, oh, I should just be able to do everything on chain, right? Like a normal on chain transaction. That's not how I view Bitcoin, because longer term, the only people who will be able to do that will be either like really rich people or basically financial institutions, right? Banks. It will be like a settlement. So my view is more like over the longer term, Bitcoin becomes like a settlement layer and people build these other layers up on top of that. But it's just that because we're so early today, you basically can use it for transactions if you really want to, but just be cognizant about some of those things around the fees and so on. Now, I guess to answer the other point though, around where someone might say, oh, but I can just use this other cryptocurrency, right? And so the answer I would give there is you have to consider how scalable that is. And you have to also consider what is the thing that made Bitcoin valuable. Part of that is its limited supply and the permissionless aspect of it. And so our view is more like if it got too centralized into, say, large companies, then those companies could get subpoenaed or the government could raid them and force a change. If there were, say, only 7 Bitcoin full nodes around the world or something like that, or 21, well, it would be much easier to shut down or influence or try to basically co-opt in some way. And so Bitcoin people, not all of us, but many of us view it like gold essentially got co-opted by the government. Essentially, gold used to act as a check against the size of the government, because if the government wanted things, it had to tax people, and taxing is not very popular, right? So the other way to do it is to push that cost into the future with debt. And so that over time is what caused them to try and centralize the, and because of the way gold works, it just gets centralized into vaults, and then people, that there's like a honeypot there, that honeypot of the vault can get taken. Whereas in Bitcoin, it's more like so many people can self-custody Bitcoin, and that's the real revolution here, is being able to self-custody your Bitcoin instead of leaving it with somebody. So that's a key difference as well to understand. So in that way, I would say Bitcoin can win where gold didn't. It can resist that tendency better than gold did. And so that's an important part to consider, right? So then bringing it back to like, oh, why can't I just use this other cryptocurrency? The problem is if you try to use every transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain, it eventually raises the cost of running the Bitcoin software. And if you raise that cost too high and you take it outside the reach of, let's say, a retail individual, and you make it so that only big companies can run it, well, now you're tending again towards that centralization, which again threatens the whole unique selling purpose, USP of Bitcoin, which is that it's decentralized and it's got a hard cap and that it's a permissionless way to send money.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's really important people understand this is a multifaceted conversation, right? And so sometimes people read across from the real world into the Bitcoin world and try and effectively force, you know, the physical into the digital, and it's not quite the same. That it is a multi-dimensional. But I guess the other dimension here we should touch on is the central bank digital currency, because of course there is a lot of initiative from a lot of central banks who are starting to talk about, well, we need to actually get our arms around the crypto land, and we need to actually be able to offer a central bank digital currency. And there are experiments running in a number of countries at the moment because they want control. They want to effectively be able to do all the things that they can do with physical money today to be able to do in digital world, right? So I guess one of my interesting questions to you is, how do you see this tussle between central bank digital currencies, often on Ethereum or other platforms, versus Bitcoin? Because they're not the same, are they?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so this whole central bank digital currency question, I think they are coming eventually. And so the question then to think about is, what sets them apart? And so the central bank coin, if you will still have to have the government's monetary policies. It won't necessarily have a set limit. And it will still have to follow the government's, you know, permission rules, right? So things like AML and FATCA and all the sanctions rules and so on that block certain transactions.
Which is, by the way, why they want to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right?
They want control.
They want to maintain the control. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. And so that is really that fork in the road, right? Do you want the money that has a hard cap and is designed to be permissionless, or you kind of just want lipstick on a pig, right? You just want the same thing as what we have now, but just in central bank coin light. Now, in fairness, a lot of people, if they do, let's say they come out in a couple of years with some central bank digital currency, of course, I think a lot of people will use it, but it won't have the same qualities that Bitcoin has. And because of that, I anticipate that over time, more people will just look at the chart, the price chart, and say, well, hold on, Bitcoin is going up, and my central bank coin is going down. Okay, I want some of that. And so that's, in my view, the longer term tendency. People will go for that because who doesn't want to have number go up, right? So basically it may in some ways act as a way that some people start getting used to this idea of like crypto, right? Having a crypto wallet or whatever. And then that may also get them more familiar and then decide, oh, hey, this Bitcoin thing is pretty good as well. I want some of that. And then that's where the conversation goes. That's what I think is a likely outcome.
But do you think there's also a risk that they will then start trying to regulate Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies more directly? Because, of course, there are reports of, bad people paying through Bitcoin and criminal activity and money laundering and all those things, which is thrown into the discussion. I suspect it's a relatively small proportion, but nobody really knows.
Right. And so, yeah, so there's some recent statistics from some of the like Bitcoin surveillance companies who they try to monitor this and try and find out how much of a percent is going through the darknet markets and so on. And so absolutely, like there are some bad people using Bitcoin. And for me, that's one of those points where I kind of bite the bullet. I say, yeah, part of if you really value freedom, obviously I don't like, there's certain uses of Bitcoin that I don't like. But the whole point is it's a permissionless network. And I think over time, it's because it's just money, it just means like the percentage of criminals out there will just be small because that's just money, right? It would be like me saying, oh, but bad people drink water too, So, but yeah, to the point though about regulation, absolutely. I think we will see governments continue to try to regulate. And now because they can't directly regulate Bitcoin, the approach that governments are essentially taking is to try and regulate the endpoints, the in and out points, if you will. So they regulate exchanges, they put AML requirements and KYC, know your customer requirements on the exchanges and various other businesses that interact with Bitcoin. Now, I think the important part there is, so long as you still can interact with Bitcoin in the permissionless way, and you can interact without the KYC, if you buy it peer-to-peer from somebody or et cetera, or you earn it online, if you set up a shop or you sell your services online, that kind of thing, as long as you can, I don't really see that as like a big, like, I don't see that, like, it is a threat, but I don't think it's going to like stop Bitcoin, if you will. So I think of it like, there's going to be kind of these two worlds to Bitcoin, right? And on my podcast, I interview people kind of across both of those worlds, if you will. Like, I interview people from, you know, big exchanges and whatever. And then on the other hand, I talk to people who are more like super privacy, only want to talk about kind of the fully permissionless kind of principled vision of Bitcoin. And so they're kind of two spheres of Bitcoin that kind of coexist in my mind.
Very interesting. And I want to draw an analogy here, because in the early days of the internet, there was a thing called Napster, right, which essentially was a relatively peer-to-peer, you know, audio sharing service, right, which basically led the way and then eventually evolved and then got spawned a whole bunch of other competitors. And now we have, you know, Apple and we have other big players, and then we've moved into video and the same stuff, and we've got you know, all the Netflix. I think that's an analogy to where we are with Bitcoin, right? I still think of Bitcoin down in the Napster domain.
It's very,
right,
early. Yeah.
Yeah, but don't, people shouldn't think that that's where it's going to stay, right? It is going to evolve, and it's going to turn into something probably with very different characteristics to the ones that it started with. What's your best guess? You know, if you look 5 years ahead, what's the Bitcoin world going to look like in 5 years' time?
Right. So, it comes back to, I guess, those two spheres of influence, right? The kind of KYC compliant side and like the non-compliant side, if you will. They're both going to grow out. And so my view is, over the next 5 years, we're going to see big, big price moves in Bitcoin over that time, just because it's kind of like a 4 year cycle beast. So it kind of moves in these big cycles. And so I think we're going to see that big kind of mega cycle play out over the next few years. In terms of ease of use, though, I think we'll see a lot of advancement in terms of being able to run in the way that gives you that kind of full power. Whereas in the earlier days, unless you were very technical, you kind of were reliant on somebody else running that infrastructure for you, right? I guess the analogy would be something like, you know, when email came out and you had to use an email provider. And right now, how many people run their own email server? Not that many, but it's becoming like, but in Bitcoin, that's a focus. So being able to run your own infrastructure is becoming easier and easier. So now we're getting to a point where people can buy like a plug and play box that represents kind of the software, and you interact with it on your phone, and that's only going to become easier and easier. So right now, yeah, I would absolutely admit it's not, if you're not so tech savvy, interacting in the very kind of raw at the kind of coalface level, that's not accessible for people. But these layers are being built up on top to make it easier. And so recently we actually saw in the US, there was an OCC, Office of the Comptroller, ruling that you know, banks there can start custodying Bitcoin for people as well. So these advancements are being made along the way. But I guess for me, from my perspective, the way I see it is, I want people to sort of take ownership themselves. And that's the important part for me, that I'm trying to encourage and try to help teach in that direction, so that more people learn how to self-custody their Bitcoins and interact with it in the permissionless way, as opposed to sort of being inside the walled garden approach, if you will.
Yeah. And of course, there are some big investment banks who are actually making quite big investments now in and around the Bitcoin world. And, you know, there's some who are very interested in where this may go. So there is definitely corporate interest in this as well, isn't there?
That's right. And we're starting to see, I think it's like a procession of different groups of people, right? So in the early days, you had to be basically really technical, really early privacy money advocates and those kinds of people. And over time, it's kind of shifting out. And so right now, I'm actually seeing a lot of macro people getting into it now. So you got guys like Raoul Powell, who literally came out and said, I'm irresponsibly long on Bitcoin right now. You've got Lynn Alden, who's also been making some waves recently. There's a lot of these people who are coming from the more macro world, and they're starting to talk about Bitcoin and holding Bitcoin. And so I think many of these people have held it in their personal accounts for a long time. well, not all of them, but many of them. And then now it's only getting to the point where they can now have it inside their funds, or they can start talking to people and family offices and so on are starting to get into it as well. So it's kind of like, and it's all over the world. So it's not just those people. It's also people in the developing world, right? Mm. So you and I, we're here in Australia. We have, you know, we have it relatively good compared to the rest of the world. But there are people in who live under like authoritarian regimes and so on, or the currency is collapsing and they need a way to save some money outside of the state. So for them, it's a global thing, right? You've got kind of rich people in the first world who want to buy it as a speculation. You've got people in the developing world who want to buy it because they you know, need it for survival, or they just need a way to get their money out, or just kind of access, you know, the financial system. So it's kind of, we're sort of seeing it span across the gamut.
Well, that's been really interesting. And, you know, thank you very much for taking us through that. And the point I want to make is that people shouldn't regard Bitcoin as just a sideshow and something that's going to disappear, right? To my mind, this is something which is going to be very much part of the furniture going forward. A lot of open questions in terms of the way it will develop. But, you know, people should take the time to really understand more about this and how it can play out. I'm not a particular bull or bear on Bitcoin, but I am intrinsically interested in it as one of the dimensions around, you know, the finance system and the finance sector. It's definitely here to stay. Now, if people want to find out more about you and your podcast and want to follow it, where do they go?
Yep, so StefanLivera.com is the main place, and you can obviously find me on Twitter or in your podcast app under Stefan Livera Podcast. And then from there, you can find all the rest.
Wonderful. Well, I thank you very much for your time today. Really interesting conversation. And maybe we'll come back and have another chat in the future sometime, because this is a fast evolving story, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Martin.
Great. Thanks very much. Take care.